Hey friends, it's your intrepid warrior, David Landjuli, with my good friend and colleague, Margaret Katzcan. Hey, Margaret.
Hey, David.
How are you today?
I'm just doing great.
All right.
Yeah.
Margaret, we got a special guest today. It's Danny Bobro, who is the creator of the Persuasion Blueprint. It's a proven framework that helps hundreds of leaders and teams turn everyday conversations into engines of caring, connection, and collaboration, leading to success in every facet of life. Danny has trained organizations to not only recover lost revenue from poor communication, do I hear nonprofit lost donors, folks, but to build cultures that win loyalty, drive referrals, and create raving fans. Danny holds dual MBAs from the University of Chicago and KUL, or KUL, in Belgium. He's also an ultra endurance athlete and a mountaineer who brings the same clarity and grit to every stage and boardroom he enters. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you very much. Thank you, David. Thank you, Margaret. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Danny, you and I had a chance to visit a few weeks back, and we share, albeit you at a much higher level, some background in mountaineering. I climbed mountains for about 15 years, but not quite at the level that you have and continue to do, I think, right?
I've had a few challenges over the past 5 years, but I've been hiking mountains. I've yet to schedule my next alpine ascent, but I'm probably looking at going back to Mount Rainier to get back into it and sort of gauge where I'm at right now. I'm 68 and had some, as I mentioned, some health and wellness challenges the last 5 years that set me back a bit, but that was just another mountain to climb. And I feel like I'm back. I've been skiing regularly and getting stronger, so I'm excited to get back on the saddle.
Oh, all right. I can't wait to hear about that. I, as many in the audience know and Margaret knows, I had a total knee replacement last year, and that has crimped my ability to do some of the things I love to do, including training jiu-jitsu. But I did get back in the mountains a few weeks ago. I went up to one of the 10th Mountain Division huts on snowshoes, and the knee did well. So I'm wishing you the same experience.
Well, I'm with the ski patrol, and we've all got our war stories. I mean, I've had shoulder surgery, knee surgery, hip replacement, pelvic fracture. So, you know, it's just kind of comes with the territory, and you, but it's amazing what people can do, both the clinicians and the patients, when they collaborate and things go right.
And my good friend here, Margaret, was a ski racer for many years and, had her fair share of broken bones and injuries as well. So here, we'll just support each other today, and anyone else in the audience who's had a few slips and falls in their lives. And we're going to shift over to some of the work that you're doing, Danny, which really piqued my interest around persuasion, because it's such an important topic in the nonprofit world, also in the corporate world, and yet it gets caught up in sort of people think of it as pressure, and you know, you talk about moving from pressure to persuasion through your 3C blueprint, and I'll just name those 3 C's. Or why don't you just walk the audience through that?
And sure, I'd be delighted to. And while we're talking about the terms, I think it's a good idea to confirm our mutual understanding, at least of the terms that I'm using them. And you mentioned sometimes people associate persuasion with pressure, as they do with sales. And, to me, persuasion is the most honest form of communication in the world, if it's done accurately and with the proper intent. you know, in the movie Shane, Alan Ladd said that a gun is just a tool. It's no more ethical. It's as ethical as the person using it. And so, you know, persuasion is a tool. You can master it. Robert Cialdini says an influence, you know, the principles of influence. Just because you can doesn't mean you should, if you know those skills. But to me, persuasion is just a collection of mindsets and skill sets that are intended to influence someone to some desirable form of action and to do it in a non-coercive way. I further like to distinguish between persuasion and convincing, because to convince someone is to perhaps get them to reconsider their opinion, attitude, or belief so that you may get them to change how they feel about something. But when we're talking about true persuasive communication, we're talking about engaging people to encourage them to take some form of desirable action. So there's a big distinction there. But the three C's, as I've identified them in persuasive communication, are caring, connection, and collaboration. To me, it is very much a sequential process, but it can be recursive at times because you can earn caring and then need to re-earn it at some later point in the relationship for a number of different reasons. When we talk about caring, one of the first things I'll share is that if you're not a caring person, then this isn't for you, because I'm not going to be able to teach you how to care. I've been blessed and fortunate to work with many people who truly do care about their fellow human being. And as I said, that's good, because I really can't teach you to be caring. But what I can do is help identify what I call the care gap, which is the difference between one's intentions and how one is being perceived by their counterpart. And so we go into some exercises and some distinctions on what it takes to demonstrate caring and to work that emotional intelligence muscle. Because numerous studies have demonstrated that people with high emotional intelligence are going to be more successful than those with innate cognitive ability or innate intelligence. Because there's so many, because you're dealing with human beings and people need to be persuaded. And the way that they're persuaded is to, first of all, know that you're dealing with someone they can trust. And the first step towards trust is to establish that caring, to minimize that care gap through embracing empathy, conveying rapport, and exuding enthusiasm. But enthusiasm is a tricky concept. You know, people can smell a bad salesperson a mile away by their misuse of enthusiasm, for instance.
Well, I think the root of that word, if I'm not mistaken, you probably know better than I do, with enthusiasm is sort of with spirit or with God is kind of where that word comes from. And yes, you can tell when someone is faking enthusiasm as opposed to actually being. It's a state of being.
Right.
Of being enthusiastic, filled with the Holy Spirit or filled with God, you know, and a lot, it has a very positive energy. So you can.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, David. I mean, it's important to have a baseline of enthusiasm, you know, so that you're sharing that spirit of openness and excitement, because nobody ever bought anything without an exchange of enthusiasm. Where you can get into trouble is when people engage in what I call blind enthusiasm, where a salesperson turns on the sales button, presses the button, and starts talking to a prospective donor or client, customer, patient, whoever it may be, and just trying to bowl them over with enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. The other person is, well, you know, why are you? I'm not excited. So, you know, so there's a mismatch there of state. And that's an important thing to avoid. I coach people on unearthing attributes and benefits of their offering that get your counterpart excited, so then you can match their enthusiasm. You can share it with them instead of initiate it and try to force it upon them.
Yeah, there's something that's coming up for me as you're speaking, which is, you know, I think that enthusiasm in our culture kind of feels very cheerleader-ish, right? Energetically, like that's kind of our association with it. And one of the things that I try to help fundraisers with is understanding actually that if cheerful is not their resonant place, that they can actually be really compelling. I mean, that their enthusiasm can take the form of intelligent communication. It can take the form of urgency. It can take the form of passion, right? That it doesn't have to be a big rah-rah kind of energy.
Passion was the word that I was going to use, Margaret. It's a specific association. It's an energy associated with something that really has to matter to your counterpart, to your prospective donor, for instance. And so, you know, I think in the nonprofit sphere more than in the for-profit, when you're in for-profit, you're usually representing some product or service. And so you unearth the needs and you're having a conversation with someone because presumably there's some fit, there's some potential fit. When you're talking to a prospective donor, they're being approached by, you know, it's more of a nebulous concept. And so it's really important to connect with that person and learn about what's important to them, what drives their passion. And even if it's a complete digression, because people like to take the measure of the person that they're dealing with. So, you know, in sales, this, which is what trying to earn a donation is, I often say that the shortest distance is not a straight line. You know, it's nice to go on seemingly meandering paths. You keep in mind what your goal is, but let your counterpart share who they are and what's important to them. And then the second C of the three C's of persuasive communication is connection.
Well, before you go there, I wanted to just say something else about caring. So a lot of folks in the audience who are in the nonprofit world are drawn to the work because they care about the mission of the organization, typically. And so that's a good place to be coming from. I think and I'd be interested in your view on this, Margaret, also, is that a lot of fundraising, a lot of what's done these days in fundraising tends to be more transactional than personal. And so there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a website button and doing annual giving, you know, via email. That's transactional in my view. What we are talking about is where the lion's share of all money in the nonprofit world gets raised, and that's through one-on-one conversations is what we're talking about here. And if you come into that conversation, no matter what stage you're at in the relationship with the donor or prospective donor, and you see that person as a transaction, they are going to smell that from a mile away, and that's not caring.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, they say that it's been said that the best salespeople in the world are the best storytellers. And so, you know, sharing stories that people can identify with and knowing how to read the cues to see if you're connecting with that person is very, very important. And I like to say that it's important to put the fun in fundraising. And, you know, my foundation, Climb for a Cause, was a way to merge my passions of oral health education and treatment with health and fitness and meeting people and helping them grow their business through cause-related event marketing. So it's an intersection, but, you know, more generally, the successful fundraiser connects with the person, shows that, recognizes their caring, demonstrates your caring, and then unearths what's important to them. And that's where connection comes in, which is, you know, a lot of people think that as a connection, well, I define it as earning trust and establishing credibility. But people sometimes lean too much on the establishing credibility side when the fact is that it's been demonstrated that people are more hungry for you to demonstrate that you understand them, you get their problem and can perhaps articulate it even better than they can, than they are about your expertise and facts. So, you know, we work hard with our coaching subjects, our students to get them to understand how to make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like we might be moving a little bit sometimes in the wrong direction here. I mean, I'm not a giant user of AI, but I will tell you every time I've asked a question about a post, like a LinkedIn post, it always, I always get the feedback, like, you have to establish your credibility first, you know, like make yourself an authority. And there's still a pretty strong voice of belief in that that's the most important thing. Danny, it sounds like you feel pretty sure. I agree. I mean, I can tell you, I 100% agree with you, but it's just interesting times we live in, because I think there really is an ongoing drumbeat towards authority, establish your authority, you're an expert, you know.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, we mentioned Cialdini, that's only one of seven principles of influence is authority. There are six others. So you want to be careful. And it's also a matter of not just what you do, but how and when you do it. We talk a lot about effective questioning and effective listening technique. And the questioning is really all about knowing when to ask open-ended questions and when to ask closed-ended questions. And we talk about the closed-ended sandwich, basically. When you're beginning a conversation, you don't really have permission to ask intimate personal questions. So what we work on is how to gain control of the call, not manipulation of the call, but if you're the you need to be in the driver's seat if you're the expert in this conversation. And so you ask closed-ended questions to get the person comfortable that you're the one asking the questions, but you do it in a way that simultaneously establishes rapport and conveys empathy. And maybe I should cite an example. We coach a number of healthcare practices on how to answer the phone from new patients, prospective patients. And we call that component the art of first impressions.
Wait a minute. I just got to stop you right there. Are there actually healthcare practices that answer the phone these days?
Eventually. If you press the right buttons.
Okay.
You don't get your buttons pushed too much. Yeah, no. And, you know, you already, Margaret, touched on AI, and I could talk at length about that. We don't want to underestimate AI, but we also don't want to overestimate it. And, you know, the most challenging component for AI is going to be to replicate human interaction. And even if and when they can, you know, surpass humans, and I'm not saying they'll never be able to, because you never know with technology, but you're going to have a hard time if you're talking to a potential funder, you know, donor, and saying, here, you know what, talk to my robot, he's better than I am. You know, so you're always gonna need to have that human connection. But the well-structured medical practice will still have a human being answer the phone as soon as possible. But even then, that's there's still a problem, because they've been trained to gather details, and there's a rather significant care gap there. Again, the difference between intention and perception. And when you call a typical office and you say, hi, I'd like to make an appointment, what's the first thing you're going to hear? Your name?
Name and date of birth, please.
Date of birth, insurance company. Right. Well, the fact is, those are important questions, but the details, someone else once said, if we're going to do business together, the details can wait. And if we're not going to do business together, the details don't matter, do they? So you want to connect on an emotional level with somebody and show, especially in healthcare. So we have a script called the TAFI, short for the Art of First Impressions, the TAFI introduction, where we coach people on how to ask closed-ended questions, but in a way that simultaneously establishes rapport and conveys enthusiasm as well in the right way. And then once you've connected with the caller, which you can do if you do this, if you master this protocol, in 30 to 60 seconds. And then you're in a position to ask open-ended questions like, you know, how can we help you today? Or, you know, why are you, you know, why did you decide that now is the time? Because you don't only want to know, you know, why they're interested, but why are they interested now? Because that helps unearth what the emotional driver is beneath the surface ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I can think of many universities that still, you know, have student callers for annual fund donations that probably could benefit from your TAFI technology, if we will.
Yeah, it can be modified for outgoing calls too, you know, for cold calls.
Right.
And those are usually qualified calls, because at least you're talking to an alumnus.
Right.
in most cases. The third element, the third C of persuasion, of the persuasion blueprint, is collaboration. And that has to do with, as the word implies, bringing your counterpart to your side of the table so that you're crafting a customized plan that they have agency and ownership in. And you can well imagine that people that have participated in the crafting of the solution are more committed to it and more likely to follow through with it.
Yeah. In our world, we might call that coactive. Right, Margaret?
Yeah, absolutely. Helping. Yeah. And, you know, in the world of fundraising, sometimes we say, if you want a donation, ask for advice. Right.
It's really good. Yeah.
People do love to be invested and have opinions and give feedback ahead of time about how a program might run or those kinds of things, the work right. that you're doing. So.
Right. And as long as it's sincere and authentic, that's a wonderful way to connect with someone. And it's a great way to learn. I never get off the phone or a meeting without having learned something. In fact, I'm going to dig deeper into the definition of enthusiasm because I want to understand that better.
Yeah. Sure.
And I thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, I think that last C is very important, whether you're selling a product, a service, which is kind of where my younger daughter is heading. She's kind of heading into the world of medical equipment sales and marketing. And at least for the time being, she'll be interning with one of those companies this summer, and she did last summer as well. So that's still a realm in the private sector or the corporate sector where products and services are still sold one-to-one by a knowledgeable, caring, connected, and collaborating salesperson.
Ideally.
Ideally. Big ticket items. Last summer, she worked on a water jet scalpel product for very specific types of surgery. So, you know, high ticket item.
Right.
Still requires a human being to facilitate that transaction, that sale. In the nonprofit world, I have made mistakes myself in this collaboration sea where, you know, you can over promise and under deliver, or in the attempt to get to a transaction. And so I'm curious if you could say a little bit more about that, because, you know, I think there's a potential trap in there.
There is. You don't want to get over your skis, so to speak, when you're doing it. And there's, in the heat of the moment, there's a tendency to do that. And that just requires discipline and a realization that you're representing a company and you might, it might make it easier for you, but then there are people that are going to have to clean up your mess. And that's not a good place to be. But, you know, in collaboration, there's a number of different things that get in people's way of effectively collaborating with their counterpart. And the most common one that I see, because I work with people who are successful and accomplished and technically or clinically competent, and I call it expert override, where you've done something so many times and you believe so much and you sincerely believe that this is in the best interest of your counterpart, that your water driven scalpel is been proven time and again to be the best product, and basically it speaks for itself, and you just sort of rattle off the attributes and the virtues of the product, and you don't really break it down to confirm your counterpart's understanding or that these various facets of the offering resonate with your counterpart. So it's a matter of slowing down and taking the time for the person to articulate, even if you've heard it 1,000 times before, is to give them the chance to articulate it. Because for one thing, you might actually learn something And even if you don't, you've given the person the opportunity to feel like they're a partner in the formulation of this plan, that they're coming along with you. They're not, it's not a TED talk, it's a dialogue. Yeah. And so that's something that we want to really try to avoid. And, you know, there are a number of other traps that people fall into when it comes to ineffective collaboration, but that's a big one that I see. Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's such a, it's a great thought exercise to go back to this idea of, you know, maybe it's a student from a university calling a list of alum. And when we think about, like, if we are the graduate of that university, yes, we're pre-qualified, but it doesn't mean that we're a donor. It doesn't mean that we had such an amazing college experience or association that we want to give. And then if we want to give, you know, God, do we want to give to the ski team, the engineering department? You know, it's just a great thought exercise to start with those two people across the table from each other.
I think it's wonderful.
How many questions need to be asked before you actually know where to go in the conversation?
Absolutely. That's a great example, Margaret, because, you know, I get calls from my various alma maters.
I think we all do. Yeah.
And, you know, you can usually tell they're more or less reading off a script. They thank you for your past support. And then they tell you about their campaign. And then they want to know, you know, what kind of support they can look forward to. And really, it would be refreshing if somebody said, well, now I see you graduated in 1986. What have you been up to since then? You know, an open question. Right. Because what you do is you find out and say, and do you feel that your education at the University of XYZ was contributed to your success?
Yeah.
You know,
or, you know, there's so many directions you could go in. And this is where I do think connecting with someone, like, what was it like on campus in 1986?
You know, I thought you were going to say 1886, David.
1886. Well, I might have been around then, Margaret.
But I like your point is that it doesn't need to relate directly back. And I think it shouldn't. I think the meandering course I mentioned earlier is be genuinely interested learning about, you know, about this person and what their experiences were and have a conversation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other thing is, this is the best sale that you can make is at the end of a conversation, you haven't asked for the money, but they said, well, you know, I've been thinking about making a donation, or I assume you're calling me to make a donation. I said, well, yeah, it was been great getting to know you, but we would certainly appreciate any support that you could provide. And then they do it without even being asked. I mean, you always want to ask for the order, but I wait as long as possible to see if they're going to offer without being asked.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's good advice. I was going in a couple of directions here. The one counter, you mentioned the word trust earlier, and in the caring and connection C's, so trust, building trust. And when you get to collaboration, I think this is where staying curious about the individual in front of you and really exploring if this is the right fit, whether you have a product or whether it's a donation to a particular project that you're raising money for. And this is a bit counterintuitive or maybe even sacrilegious to say, like, actually just listening to you, this may not be the right fit for you right now. I think that goes a long way to building trust for something else down the road. If it's true and honest and, you know, you're not trying to manipulate the person and just really like listening to you, this, you know, we're raising money for this project and it just sounds like this is not a fit for you right now. I think
you don't even have to go that far. You could say, I'm wondering whether this is a fit.
Yeah.
And then you have that whole exploration together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as over-promising and under-delivering, you know, it's nice to be able to earmark. Sometimes, you know, the donor, you want to give the donor some flexibility. Well, you know, can I make sure the money goes to the School of College of Commerce or to the your mission in Sri Lanka? And sometimes entities are able or in a position to do that, and sometimes they aren't. I think the more flexibility you offer, the more you can craft the solution for the specific donor. But I like the idea of of challenging them. You know, it's like, because there's different kinds of yeses too, and people will give you, you know, a confirmation or a counterfeit yes when we think it's a commitment yes. And sometimes yeses are given just to get us off the phone, right? So it's nice to get several yeses before you actually hang up with somebody or before you have convinced, you know, they need to convince you that they're for real, that this is going to fit. And so, you know, we coach people on asking questions like, well, what does our association need to look like a year from now for you to be glad that you decided to work with us? You know, or what would you like to see in terms of how your funds are being used? What would be sufficient feedback for you? You know, make it real so that you can paint a picture for them of what they might expect and that it's consistent with what they want. And they may not know what they want. So this exercise is a really helpful one to get them to articulate in their own mind what would make the difference for them.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to where in this conversation of caring, connection, and collaboration, where does intuition come in?
Well, you know, just like emotional intelligence, some people seem to have it and some people don't. I happen to say
everybody has it. I think some people have been conditioned to turn the volume down to a big mute so they don't listen to it anymore.
Quite possibly. Or they just haven't practiced that muscle. They haven't exercised that muscle. So, you know, intuition is sort of a big black box that, you know, to me, it's like, well, were you born with it or not? And, you know, sometimes being gifted, and I know I had some people close in my life that had innate ability athletically and academically, and things came very easily to them. And that when it came to adulthood or, you know, after early adulthood, things didn't come as easily. They didn't have the discipline and the training to work through challenges, to overcome, when things didn't just come to them naturally or quickly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't have to tell you or your audience that hard work is the great equalizer. And if you just make a commitment to something and you have exposure to the right teacher, to the right people, then because you can make the same mistakes over and over again. I've worked with, you know, I'm a ski instructor, if I didn't mention that, not just a ski patroller. And I've worked with people who've skied for 25 years and yeah, they can get down the hill, but they've been making the same mistakes for 25 years. So, you know, it's a matter of being open to learning, because we're all human beings, are all creatures of habit, and we really resist rewiring our neural pathways. But if you're going to grow, you have to stretch.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking more in terms of, just to build on what Margaret said, you know, the my intuition got mostly snuffed out of me by the educational industrial complex, and it wasn't until much later in life that I started to rewire, as you say, that side of my brain that has this sensing ability, especially when you're with other people. And so, you know, you mentioned the word script, and I think where, you know, folks who are conditioned, left brain conditioned, they want to follow that, do this, do that, do the other thing, and then this, the donation or the sale drops out the other end. Well, that isn't actually, that can work that way, and it sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And I do think this is where, whether you're in sales or whether you're in fundraising, knowing when to turn or when to stop, when to listen, when to speak, this is where I think the land intuition lives. Yeah.
Well, I do too. And intuition needs to be nurtured and cultivated. If you're in an environment that snuffs it out and tells you that, no, this is the way to do it, then it's never going to develop. So, I agree with you.
Yeah. So when we had our pre-call, I think you mentioned there's a, is there an assessment, Danny, that you have for folks or something that they can grab onto that could help them?
There is. We call it the persuasion scorecard, and we basically encourage anyone who's interested in learning more about the persuasion blueprint to start there, because it's a, it basically gives us a baseline of where you are in terms of caring, connection, and collaboration, and then we sort of build from there. It's complimentary. It's 21 questions that you can find at our website, DannyBobrow.com.
Okay.
And from there, the next step is we offer 7 modules, video modules, with yours truly delivering the coaching. They average only about 15 minutes each. I developed this with sort of me in mind, me being representative of busy people who sort of can only handle so much information at a time and then need a break. And that's part of our brain wiring too. You know, I think it's the reticular activating system that just says, after 8 minutes or so, somebody better tell us a joke or tell us to stand up and stretch in a meeting, or else we're going to fall asleep or go for the coffee. So that's how it's structured. And yes, we do suggest that people begin with the persuasion scorecard.
Great. Got it. Make sure that's in the show notes for the podcast.
Yeah. And so the scorecard is complimentary at your website, and it'll give folks, whether you're in sales or whether you're in fundraising, it'll give you a sense of where you stand with regard to the 3 C's. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I have a background in marketing, and one of the cardinal sins of marketing is to try to be all things to all people. With that said, and I think the reason I'm so passionate about the Persuasion Blueprint is that it transcends all industries and all interactions. If you're trying to do a better job of connecting with your teenage son, or with a parent, or a sibling, or a superior, or a counterpart, a subordinate in healthcare, in nonprofit, these are universal distinctions, and I am very, very confident in saying that they will help you in all your communications, regardless of what form they take.
Awesome. Anything else, Margaret?
No, this sounds like a perfect pause spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Danny, thanks so much for being on the show. It's I really appreciated you reaching out to us and to share your persuasion blueprint with the audience, and been a lovely guest, and we appreciate having you here.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you both for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
Okay.